So I thought, you know, a couple folks might be dressed up for Halloween. I didn't realize you all would dress up like starving college students. Nice. I actually had a full horror mask I was going to put on and pop up, and then I thought, maybe that's too much. So one more time, happy Halloween. Apparently it's tonight. Lecture notes, page 160, lecture 18. Think about international travel. Think about, is anyone actually interested in digital marketing? We don't, is anybody conceptually you're interested in it? Yeah. Sign up for that. If we don't get a couple students in there, they're going to bag it. So go sign up when it's your turn. So that should be interesting, I think. In general, not just for our course, if you're considering withdrawing from any 15-week course, note that the deadline is, somewhere I saw it as the third, somewhere I saw it as the second. If it's really important to you, double-check it. But I'm putting up the second. Withdrawing gives you a W on your transcript. Otherwise, if you're in the class after the deadline, you get a grade, even if you didn't want one. So, as always, it might be wise to check with your academic advisor if you're thinking about withdrawing. Mini test 8, average score 88%. 89% of the students took 8. I don't know what that trend means. It's not good. And 9 will open tomorrow, closing on Saturday, usual schedule. Enhanced learning extra credit number 1 in PACBACK. Not 1, but what are we on? 6. Have been open, and it will close Wednesday, and 7 will open Thursday. So, looking ahead in the calendar, it's probably worth mentioning, midterm 2 is on its way. It's worth 17% of your course grade. It'll cover everything since midterm 1, so it's non-cumulative. So it covers lectures 11 to 20, which is what you'll see covered on mini tests 6 to 10, and on the review tests for 6 through 10, if you want to study for it using those. I don't know exactly what we'll get to for the end of the material mini test 2, but we do know that mini test 6 began on lecture notes page 93 and textbook page 158. So if you wanted to get a jump on it, that's where you would start. Midterm 2 opens on Saturday, November 11th, and closes at 8 a.m. and closes at 6 p.m. on Tuesday, November 15th. Note the closing time. It's 6 p.m. It's not the middle of the night. So I was thinking about academic integrity when my wife found this for me. This was a series of masks created for in-person courses in the Philippines by an engineering class. She turned them loose and said, hey, design something that would be anti-cheating. Can't really see all those funny masks, but they have dangly things down the side and things hiding them, etc. That didn't help me with online testing. But it still got me thinking about what I was unhappy about in the last test. So here, I realize now the black on purple doesn't show up as well as I had hoped it would, but I will read it to you. For midterm 2, don't have any digital devices near you during the test. This will eliminate me hearing that you had problems with your significant other, with your family, with your friends, that you had to text in the middle of an exam. If you don't have the device near you, you can't do that. We won't have this misunderstanding. Also, we won't have a misunderstanding about what I'm seeing when I see this in the camera, in the video, because it won't be there. So don't have it. What else was I complaining about? So if you know you can have some kind of issue or problem where you need to have, oh, yeah, somebody told me they had a smartphone addiction, so they were sorry they had to have their smartphone by them. If that's your story, if that's your situation, email me. We'll set up an in-person exam, and I'll hold your phone near you so you can't use it, all right? So I'm wanting to work with you, but stop screwing around with me. So don't have any digital device near you, and there won't be a problem. Second, don't be looking up and down constantly, side to side constantly, or over the top of your screen constantly during the exam. If you're using a book or a lecture notes, you've shown it to the camera, then use them when you look away. That's fine. I'm not trying to screw with you either. And, you know, if you have to scat the cat away or tell mom that you're taking it, I'm not looking to mess with you. But some people are messing with me. And there's no excuse for doing this during the entire test. No book, no notes, and you're doing something. Whatever you're doing, stop it. So if you say, look, that's stupid, I can't sit and look at a computer screen straight on for 80 minutes or whatever, fine, email me, we'll set up an in-person exam. That's fair, you have ADD, you can't look at a screen, it makes you sick, great, we'll do it a different way. So, I can't make you wear funny masks.
These will be the new rules.
Questions on any of that, or why I'm doing it, or it doesn't seem fair, or whatever. And a whole bunch of us shouldn't have any problems with this, because most of us are taking the test as we should. Don't lie, don't cheat, don't steal. We're doing it honestly. Some of us are messing around. We good? Webites, you awake? You catch any of this? Wake up. Okay? Yes. Okay. Thank you. So having any digital device with you, constantly looking away from the screen during the exam, unless you're looking at the book or notes, will be considered as cheating. You will hear from me. Don't do it. And if you think you have problems, let me know. We'll do it in person. It's fine. We good on that? Does that seem fair, equitable, reasonable, trying to hold an academic integrity in place? No, saying nothing. All right, over to business in the news. So companies are taking different strategies to navigating high inflation. Procter & Gamble, for example, is ramping up advertising on their premium brands. Verizon is raising prices on its wireless plans. Whirlpool Corporation, the appliance manufacturer, has slashed production of its appliances. So what we're seeing is corporate strategies for dealing with the economic impact of inflation, one of the crest factors, right? Competition, regulation, legal and political, economic, social, and technology. This would fall in the domain of macroeconomic issues, inflation. High levels of inflation in the U.S. and shifts in underlying demand are putting the spotlight on the strategies that executives are taking to navigate a global economy where costs are rising and consumer appetite for some products is dropping. The average consumer has become increasingly price sensitive as the years progressed, says Hasbro CEO Chris Cox. The maker of Nerf and other toys reported third quarter sales fell 15% because of the timing of product releases, and that profits were pinched because it had to increase promotional activity amid a buildup of inventory before the upcoming holidays. So we're seeing the release of new products, which we talked about, bad timing as it happens against inflation, and their promotional strategy to help fix the problem. P&G, that sells household staples such as Pampers and Tide, is spending on high-profile advertising campaigns and new product features to keep cash-crunched consumers from switching to cheaper brands. So they're releasing new products, new features, and using advertising. And the advertising theme is, hey, stick with our higher-priced product, but you'll still be happy, you'll still save money. You may have seen this campaign running. And the idea is, it's worth it sticking with us.
This is Annie.
Annie Murphy. This is a cold call. We're calling to get you to turn to cold washing with Tide.
Unsubscribe.
Wait. This helps the environment.
And saves you money.
Oh, the environment. Yeah. With the trees and the shrubs. How much money?
$100 a year on your energy bill. It's like getting paid for doing nothing.
I will take that money for the environment.
This was a cold call.
So stay with our product, stay with our cold water Tide, and save $100 a year. We're trying to keep you with our Tide product. In most recent quarter, higher commodities, materials, and freight costs reduced its gross profits by 5.5%, which was fully offset by cost cuts and price increases. You know from very basic accounting, also we'll be talking about this, that profit is equal to revenue minus cost. So how do you increase your profit? Either find ways to boost revenue, which is quantity times price. So increase your price and hope, of course, elasticity doesn't drive your demand down. Or reduce your costs, or both. And that's what these companies have been struggling with, and they were able to offset their reduction in the gross profit margin by cost-cutting and price increases. CFO Andre Schutten said P&G has enough brands and price levels to give customers options within its own portfolio. There was growth in the mid-tier brands during the quarter, but also customers spending more on large-size packages to lower their per-use price. The strategy to provide pack sizes that stretch from below $10 for some channels and consumers to above $30 or $40 for others seems to be meeting consumers' needs. So brand and price strategy for these different segments of the marketplace. Verizon and AT&T both raised prices on some of their cell phone plans over the summer, a strategy that yielded widely different outcomes. AT&T reported a third quarter net gain of 708,000 postpaid phone connections, its most valuable customer category, a sign that few of those subscribers that were affected balked at the higher monthly prices. So this is price in the mix, dealing with inflation, and price elasticity of demand. As you know, we'll talk about later, the basic principle is that when price goes up, what happens to demand basically? Price goes up. What happens to demand? Thank you. Where's my econ guy? And my only guy who actually pays attention to answers. Thank you. All right, so I appreciate it. So, in general, that's true, depending on the price elasticity of demand. So we feel it's important enough to stay with our plan, and so our demand doesn't fall. Verizon's more widespread rate of fee increase drove down the same type of phone connections in its consumer segment. New business lines barely offset that decline, and the telecom company ended the September quarter with a relatively weak 8,000 phone gain. Executives of both companies said higher rates helped to boost profits. Price, demand, revenue, and profits all interconnected. Other companies, such as Whirlpool, are feeling whiplash from a sudden drop in demand for their products. At the same time, they're confronting high costs for materials, energy, and other expenses. Whirlpool isn't turning to discounting, lowering prices, to move unsold fridges and dishwashers. Instead, it slashed production by 35% to shrink down their inventories rather than try to get rid of the product with lower prices. Fastenal, a major distributor of industrial supplies, B2B, nuts and bolts, has been raising prices to offset rapidly increasing costs, but the recent quarter showed signs of stability in costs, their costs, along with some resistance from consumers, B2B consumers saying enough is enough. So they're trying to deal with inflation in the B2B market. At this stage of the economic cycle, the marketplace is less receptive to further price increases. Product pricing in the marketplace is stable, and there are tenuous signs of product inflation easing. So that's something we can all hope for. How many of you guys know Claire's? Claire's, you know from the mall? Is that where you would know it from, the mall? Yeah. So, of course, has anybody gone to a mall in the last few months? Do people still go? My wife went, where do teens, when you were younger, hang out? You don't hang out at the mall anymore. That's not a thing. That used to be a huge thing. People's houses, what do? Hang in the metaverse? Okay, so you're hanging out online with others? All right, so Claire's targets Jen, write this one down, Zalfa, with Roblox Virtual Destination. Retail chain Claire's is in the midst of a comeback after exiting bankruptcy, looking to secure its appeal to tweens and young teens. Claire's effort into the metaverse directly targets Gen Zalpha. So here's their target market. We haven't heard about Gen Zalpha before. Gen Zalpha is a cohort of younger Gen Zers and older members of the following Gen Alpha cohort. This micro-generation is largely characterized by coming of age during the pandemic when they were physically isolated from their social circles but were able to connect through online platforms like Zoom, Metaverse, and perhaps more importantly for the Metaverse, games like Roblox and Fortnite. So we're understanding our target market, our target audience. Claire's has a new virtual destination, Shimmerville, that uses the Roblox platform to amplify the brand's purpose of empowering self-expression and personal style. So we're seeing technology and marketing. We're seeing us positioning the brand. We're seeing the Metaverse and marketing. And Claire's that spin to win. And Claire's the fairly old, reliable mall marketer. Game on. Experience the magic of Claire's in our new digital world on Roblox. Shimmerville is positioned as more than a game, enabling visitors to earn digital currency through playing mini games and completing retail jobs. Players can then use these earnings to purchase accessories for their avatars, homes, and vehicles. Among the destinations within Shimmerville are a park that will host live events, a pet adoption center, a play park, and a mall, ironically, with stores selling accessories and merchandise, a spot for building a custom house, and a galleria where events and experiences will be held. So obviously we are trying to engage that Zalpha audience online. Claire's venture into the metaverse is an investment in the brand's fidgetal future, where experiences in the physical and digital world can be somewhat interchangeable. For example, the avatars accessories that you can buy in Roblox in their magical zone are also available for purchase in bricks and mortar Claire's stores. So we're getting in-store activity from our online metaverse connection. Venturing into the metaverse, and in particular on Roblox, is a way several younger skewing brands are trying to reach their target audiences. Last month, My Little Pony launched Visit Maritime Bay. Invisalign, whose main population of users will be adolescents experiencing orthodontia, also launched a destination on Roblox. So here we are seeing the adaptation of technology in marketing to reach our target audiences. Finally, I couldn't let this pass because, you know, I'm obsessed with that long story about Starbucks and how they've been managing their brand, et cetera, over time. And I already told you that story so far, and I'm going to have to add this. Those poor guys next year have to hear this, too, because Nestle's is buying Seattle's best coffee from Starbucks. Nestle says it has agreed to acquire Seattle's best coffee brand from Starbucks, bolstering the Nescafe and Nespresso owners' coffee business in the U.S. So we're seeing corporate growth strategies, global marketing, manage the brand portfolio. And somebody mentioned that they were in public relations. We don't have a lot of public relations people in our classes in general, but somebody said that. One of the things PR people would be doing is creating press releases for this sort of event. And so I take you over briefly to their press release on this particular decision out of their corporate headquarters in Vevey, Switzerland. So there is a press release. The world's largest packaged food maker, Nestle's, said that the acquisition of the brand, which sells a range of packaged coffees in grocery stores as well as in locations such as workplaces, universities, and hotels, would add depth to its North American portfolio. Nestle's didn't disclose the terms of the deal, strategic growth via acquisition. Now, you made a funny face at me when I said this sale was happening. Why did you make a funny face? Say again? A chocolate brand buying coffee. So one, I thought you were making the face for another reason. Nestle's has a vast portfolio of products, but good point. I thought you were saying in your mind, why is Starbucks giving up one of its coffee brands, which we're about to get to? So coffee has been one of Nestle's best performing categories in recent years. The company's coffee products benefited from consumers drinking more brews at home during the pandemic. And in fact, demand has remained high, partly helped by people who are continuing to work from home. So we're seeing the continuing impact of the pandemic. For Starbucks, the sale of Seattle's best comes as the company looks to focus more on its core strength, retail stores. Last month, they brought him back again. Interim Chief Executive Howard Schultz is back, outlined a wide-ranging revamp of the coffee chain, ranging from cafe upgrades to expanding employee benefits. So we're seeing retail store strategy. We're seeing focus on their core segment and letting go of this stuff that sells in grocery stores, etc. Nestle's and Starbucks actually have an alliance, which has introduced a wide range of premium coffee products to new markets at a fast pace, including whole bean coffee, roasted and ground coffee, as well as Starbucks capsules for Nespresso and Nescafe Dolce Gusto proprietary systems. Today, Nestle's distributes Starbucks customer products and food service beverages across more than 80 markets outside Starbucks retail stores under the Global Coffee Alliance. So we're seeing brand partnerships. We're seeing a bit about getting involved in global markets. In this case, Starbucks making use of Nestle's distribution to get its product out. Nestle's also reported a surge in sales revenue for the first 9 months of the year, driven by higher selling prices for their products, which also includes Kit Kat chocolate and Perrier water. Price increases were particularly steep in North America, up 11.1%, inflation strikes. So price in the marketing mix, the impact of inflation on marketing. Companies across the consumer products industry are grappling with how much to increase prices to offset higher costs for ingredients, transport, and labor, while avoiding alienating consumers, also struggling with the high level of inflation. So again, price in the marketing mix, impact of inflation on marketing, and a continuation of how Starbucks chooses to manage its products, manage its brands. So I've mentioned over time that over years I've taken many students, haven't done so much recently, on trips to Europe, and this is actually a group of our students a few years ago at Nestle's headquarters in Vevey, Switzerland. Hi, guys. All right, so we pick up with lecture notes, page 160 and page 295 in the textbook. Here we go. So we were talking about the product life cycle. And as we were just talking about it, what I tried to differentiate or emphasize was that we're not talking about, in the lecture slides, we weren't talking about the product life cycle. We were talking about a change in the macroeconomics life cycle of this inflation. Is it slowing up? But here we're talking about products. We were talking about the idea of the decline stage of the product life cycle. We looked at things like board games being replaced by electronics. We looked at orange squeezers being replaced by fancier stuff, by frozen products. And so I'm trying to remember if that's where we got. Did we get this far? Does this look familiar? I think we got that far. So what are most competitors going to do at this stage of the product life cycle? They're going to get out. Enough already. I'm done. The thing isn't... I'm sorry. Is that too fast? Okay. I thought maybe I skipped stuff. Could happen. So they say, fine, bag it. I'm out of the business. Some companies are able to find an interesting little niche or twist on that particular market that's declining for everybody else. You guys have seen in front yards celebrating parties with pink flamingos, all right? That's not the big thing it used to be, but you still see it sometimes. Yeah, the company that made these said, I'm out of it. It's declined. I quit. Another guy said, you can't quit. He bought it up, and he's focused, whenever you see it, on this little niche of people that still like pink flamingos in the yard. So a little niche, even though it's in decline for most people. What's that thing up there on the left? Pot-bellied stove. Used to be the way in early America you heated your house and cooked. Most of us have given up on pot-bellied stoves to heat our house and to cook. But of course, some of us still like the concept. So on the right-hand side, we see a very designer take on an old fire stove. You can find a specialized thing sometimes. So the product life cycle diagram suggests that the stages are of equal length the way I drew it out. Typically, that's not accurate. That's not the case. And the overall length, how long it takes from introduction to decline, certainly varies by product category and by industry. So consider fashion. Would you say that fashion has a long product life cycle or a short product life cycle? Short, very short, right? A season and it's gone, typically. Which is why my wife explains every other season she has to buy another pair of jeans because the old ones are out of style. They're jeans. How can they be out of style? But okay, it's fine. Versus something like playing cards. As far as I know, they're still a thing. People still use them. They've been around forever. So the product life cycle there is pretty long, yeah? Fashion, pretty short. So here is a diagram where I'm trying to show an extended introduction stage into the before the growth. It takes a long time. An example that I like simply because I was with a company that sold microwave ovens a long time ago. In 1947, the first commercial microwave hit the market. These primitive microwave units were gigantic, enormously expensive. They were 5.5 feet tall. They weighed over 750 pounds, and they cost about $5,000 in 1947. The magneton tube had to be water-cooled, so you had to have a plumbing installation. You can see why this was not a popular consumer item in 1947. And it took a long, long time for this thing to catch on. It wasn't until 1975 that the sales of microwave ovens for the first time exceeded that of gas ranges 28 years after they came out, before they were really going strong. Some other issues in getting the acceptance of microwave ovens. Remember I talked about new products succeeding, and one of the things that made it succeed is simplicity. People did not understand how to use it. Compatibility of use. Nothing the way your grandmother used to cook works on a microwave oven. You can't just take that nice pan and put it in the microwave. What is the recipe like? We know it more now. They didn't get it. So it took a long time for this thing to come out of the box and to be successful. On the other hand, you have product life cycles that are very short. We call them fads. Yeah? So anybody remember Gangnam Style? Right? No? Yeah? No? So, song released in 2012 by South Korean musician Psy, became the first YouTube video ever to reach 1 billion views. It ignited a worldwide craze.
Extreme MAGA Republicans are fired up to vote, turning out to take control of Congress and roll back the landmark climate law Democrats passed. And they're counting...
That isn't what I was shooting for.
Oppan Gangnam Style. Oppan Gangnam Style. Gangnam Style.
All right, maybe I overemphasized that, but do you remember it as an event or not? Yeah? So, in and out, though. Hardly anybody's doing that today. RoboSapien? It walks, it talks, it grabs stuff, it throws stuff. Heck, it can even do kung fu. Never heard of it? Well, that's because after its 2004 heyday, which saw 2 million units sold, The Robo Sapien took a nosedive. Boop. Pretty much a fad. 2 million in 1 year. Boy, we got a whoops. No, we don't. So, I don't know what you can relate to here. Who remembers Beanie Babies? Beanie Babies in the day, man, they, you know, everybody was getting them for gifts, wanting them for gifts. Grandparents were giving them to kids for gifts. There were really expensive ones. You could buy one in a glass case with a mink stole. Not so much anymore. Who remembers Pogs? Anybody remember Pogs? Or is that was came and got, went before you? Oh, really? I got to drop that example. Pogs were a game that actually was so popular, elementary schools had to stop allowing kids to bring them in. You'd have these Pogs. They were like little cardboard things. You'd stack them up. You'd throw something. They would fall. If they fell out of the circle, you lost them to other people. They were wildly whoops, gone. Pet Rocks, Pogo Ball. How about those things? Yeah, I think those are still around, aren't they? Not so much, though. A little bit. All right, so maybe they're still stretched a little bit. Pokemon? Who's still doing Pokemon? Are you raising your hand, sir? Yeah. But do you remember there was a summer or so when everybody was walking around, walking into streets and buildings and stuff, trying to chase down the Pokemon character? Those, no? Yeah. So those things came and went, too. All right, so fads. A lot of them. And some products seem to have an indefinitely long maturity stage. I would argue playing cards are still out there. Refrigerators. What are you replacing your refrigerator with? What's that new product that's there is nothing, right? So they've been around a long time, and they're still out there a long time. Coca-Cola, classic, still out there, still selling products. They had another record-breaking profit last quarter. So they just seem to be out there going on and on and on. For many, many products, the product life cycle seems to be getting shorter, in part because you just find competition, watching and seeing what you're doing. You're successful. They're going to come up with an advancement and try to satisfy your consumers better than you are. There goes that product. And because in the area of technology, it's just rapid technological change. Product's good today, gone tomorrow. The product life cycle can be affected by a variety of things. One of the things it can be affected by is its use. Anybody know the product called Retin-A? Is that something you've heard of? Retin-A? Retin-A? Retin-A initially came out. It was being used for acne, to clear up your skin. Some people noticed an interesting side benefit of using Retin-A. So as it began to fade, it turns out that Retin-A also cured wrinkles. Not so important when you're a teen with acne, but other people were very interested in that idea. So once they discovered this was a wrinkle-reducing product, they were able to extend the product life cycle for Retin-A by coming out with a bunch of beauty products. So an interesting extension, how it was being used. Differences in geographic markets. So once your market fills up at home and that brand or product life cycle is beginning to fade, take it global, grow it somewhere else. And so that extends the product life cycle in the global market is another way to go. So obviously KFC, McDonald's having pretty good growth in China, Japan, etc. The product life cycle is also affected by the characteristics of your target market. So this is what we're looking at when we talk about the characteristics of people who adopt your brand over time. So early on, when the thing is just coming up, who's going to buy it? It's expensive. It's hard to find. It doesn't have all the features and benefits it's going to have. Who in the world would want such a thing? Well, we actually talked about that last time. There's a group of folks out there that are innovators. They're venturesome. They're well-educated. They have money. And they use multiple sources of information to track down this interesting new stuff. And they want to be the first on the block to have whatever that thing is. So you might be an innovator in some particular area of interest. You want the best one. You want the first one. Yeah? Then over time, as the product is out there for a while, we move over to early adopters. These are folks that are leaders in social settings. They're slightly above average education. They don't jump on the bandwagon right away, but after they see the way the wind is blowing, they want to get in. And they sort of are influences for other people. Over time, as the product itself begins to grow more, we hit the early majority market. These are folks that are more deliberate. They mainly use informal social contacts. They're not leaders. They're the early followers. Then as we move on to the mature stage, we get the late majority. These are skeptical people, typically below average social status. They're late followers. And then way out there, there might be some folks that are laggards. These folks are not risk takers. They don't have a lot of education. They don't have a lot of money. They don't have a lot of resources. They're going to pick it up when it's well established. These are the laggards then, fear of debt. Neighbors and friends are their informational sources. So in general, we say there are about 2.5% of a population are innovators, 13.5% of a population are early adopters, 34% are early majority, 34% late majority, 16% laggards. That's assuming you stick around to go through the full product life cycle. If you don't, maybe you never get the innovators going, you just don't get sales, you're gone. All right? So this also influences the length of the product life cycle and whether or not these various types of consumers are interested in your product. So successful marketers need to do well at predicting the shape and the timing of the product life cycle. Is it going to be a long one or is it going to be a fast? That's going to influence your production, your costs, your sales estimates, your advertising. And where are you in the product life cycle? Are you still in growth? Have you begun to reach maturity? That's going to influence your product design. It's going to influence your marketing. And then recognizing what stage they're in and adapting to that stage. Last time we looked at different strategies, whether you were in the introduction stage, growth stage, maturity stage, decline stage. So you have to know what's going on. You have to pay attention to it. Interesting questions for marketers. When do you want to enter into a new product environment? Do you want to go in first? Arguably, you might have a pioneering advantage. So you come in the introductory stage. Amazon wasn't the first seller of books online, but Amazon.com was the first significant company to make an entrance into the online book market. Then how did that work out for them over time? Pretty good, okay? They came in early, they were willing to risk it, see if it worked, and they stuck with it. eBay had a first mover advantage that allowed it to dominate the online auction space. They're still quite big in that arena. Or you may hang back. You may wait and see what's going on out there. There's a good idea. Let me see if I can do that better because of my power, my money, my audience. For example, the first low-cal, no-cal beverage was zero-calorie, no-cal soda pop. Needless to say, none of us know that product. None of us know that brand. Why not? It came out, and once the big brands saw that it was successful, they jumped on board with a whole slew of diet, low-cal, no-cal products. So they were a follower, worked great for them. So different strategies will work for you. As you're on the rise, you need to use differentiation. So there's an existing product, things change, products change, technology changes, and of course we go from the original, what is that, Atari? I'm going to find that in my basement. So video games introduced in the 1970s, but we have technological leapfrog over time. We differentiate our products more and more, the Xbox, Sony PlayStation, Nintendo Wii, so we've got to keep advancing our products as the product life cycle grows. During maturity, well, gosh, everybody knows about us. We've been around for a while. So what are we going to do? Well, this takes us back to our example from Sherwin-Williams here, their Dutch Boy product, and their innovation in a very mature product line, Dutch Boy's packaging. Innovation offers paint and plastic containers, twist-off tops, easy to carry. And you're going to advertise that. Hey, we're out here. You know us. And don't want to do any of that. And so here is their website talking about their innovation in this very mature product category. And surviving the decline. That's going to be a pretty big challenge. Things are not growing. Consumers are not clamoring for your product anymore. But you might find something you're able to do. Anybody know what Eagle brand blank blank is? Anybody know what that is? Any cooks in the audience? Any cooks out there? Have you ever heard of condensed milk? This is condensed milk. shelf-stable milk in a can, really big in the Civil War when refrigeration was not possible. What do you do as time goes on? There's not a huge demand for it, but if you can be smart, you can find a way to survive the decline stage. In this case, Eagle Brand found a way to promote it as a key ingredient in making various treats easily and throughout the year, and especially for some special holiday treats. So there's a small audience into cooking who really want to use condensed milk in that upcoming holiday candy spree. During the decline stage, you've got to ensure that marketing and production programs are as efficient as possible. You don't have a boatload of money flowing in. There's not a lot of revenue coming in. So whatever you're doing, make sure it's efficient. Get rid of any unprofitable sizes and models. Over that growth and maturity stage, you might have blown up in terms of the sizes, the colors, the models, the shapes. Pare it down to the core in the decline stage. Run the product out to squeeze out the final profits that you can get, whatever's left. Or find a way to revitalize it. That's the toughest route, but maybe you can find a way to do the equivalent of, hey, use our condensed milk in your candy for your product. So a term that we use a lot throughout all of this as we talk about product is the idea of brands. Brands are fairly important to us. A brand is a living business asset. It is the business strategy brought to life across all touch points, which, if you manage it properly, creates identification from the consumer to the brand, differentiation against competition, and value so your consumers are loyal, buy your product, and bring in revenue. We borrow this from Interbrand, and we have a YouTube video somewhere on that. Here he is. This is Jez Frampton talking about this.
So if you do actually concentrate on understanding how your brand creates value for your organization, it can be very, very successful for you over time. Because these things don't happen in a heartbeat. Because you're dealing with people's emotions, their connections with you, how they feel about you, and you have to deliver, of course. So there we are in the age of value. And then during that period of time, something very interesting happened to the way that people see brands within the context of their organization. Increasingly, the brand becomes effectively the business strategy brought to life. And this is the way you have to think nowadays if you are ever going to achieve that holy grail of marketers right now, the seamless connected experience. Because unless the brand influences the behavior and actions of every part of your organization, there is no way you are ever going to be able to deliver that. So if you remember one thing from this, brands are business strategy brought to life. Simple stuff. If you can encourage your organization to think like that, and if you think like that, and if you can encourage your colleagues in the rest of your organization to think like that, you will be successful. You will make a difference. But it's, unfortunately, things have moved on again. So there we are, happily in the age of value, understanding our brand create value. And then we approach this thing called the age of experience. This is where we are now. So this is real stuff. It's not just us making it up. It's based upon empirical information on the views of CEOs, CMOs, CTOs, and everyone else who's got a C at the front of their title. So we enter the age of experience, and who better to sort of demonstrate that than that? But the big thing that really happened, of course, was this. The power is shifting. People have said to me, and I'm sure they've said to you, and you may even said it yourself along the time, that the customer owns the brand. The customer doesn't own the brand. The customer dictates what the brand should be. Because they're the ones who have expectations. They're the ones who have beliefs about what they might experience when they come into contact with your organization. They don't own it. But they are a massive influence on it.
If they're not a massive influence on it, then you're not satisfying their needs, wants, and desires, and their expectations. You fail. So we have to understand our brand and the value that it brings to the consumers very well. So the word brand as a term is comprehensive. Brands are used to both identify a seller Apple, and to differentiate a product from the competition, Tide versus all. Within this, then, we can talk about a brand name, which isn't going to be too complicated. It's the words, the letters, and the numbers that you can say, that you can vocalize. Okay? So brand name is the things that you can say. Pier 1 Imports, Procter & Gamble, Nordstrom's, Hugo Boss, Victoria's Secret, all brand names. A brand mark, also part of the brand, is a symbol or a design or a color or lettering that is identified with the brand. How? Because they've done a good job of promoting it, creating brand position, building up the image in your mind. So what brand is that? Nike? Now that particular image is so popular it has its own name. It's the Nike Swoosh, okay? But that's not the brand. It's Nike, not the Swoosh, right? What's the one on the left? Firefox, Mercedes, Shell, Apple, Pepsi, and the Cleveland Guardians. So these are images that should bring to mind the brand, and then whatever you think about that brand, if they've done a good job of positioning it in your mind. We also have the idea of word marks, where we combine certain color elements, script elements, as you can see, images with our brand. So the Google look, the Coca-Cola look, the Microsoft look, two images here, brand marks of scribbles versus Starbucks. Of course, Starbucks doesn't need to have any text at all. On the other hand, scribbles still needs to let you know who they are. So these are word marks, also part of the brand. So brand is a broad term. These word marks are also known as logos or logotypes, and they stand in for the brand in the minds of the consumer. Trademark is really important because it's the legal protection of the brand. You spent a lot of money designing the thing, promoting the thing, building up the brand image of the thing in the mind of the consumer. You don't want somebody else taking it over. And so you have to legally protect it. Companies strive vigorously to protect their trademarks. Anybody know what that was? WWF? World Wrestling Federation? Anybody remember that? Or is that's too old? Yeah, you remember it? Okay. Are they still WWF? They are not WWF. Do you know why? Because the World Wildlife Foundation said, that's our letters. I would think that somebody would say, no one's going to confuse a bunch of wrestlers with a bunch of pandas. The court said otherwise. So WWF had to drop that, and they became WWE, World Wrestling Entertainment, because WWF said, that's my trademark, you cannot use it. Although I'm not sure how wrestlers were confused with pandas, but okay. So that was the legal stance. Periodically we'll hear some poor little kindergarten school somewhere has Disney characters painted on their walls or something, and periodically you hear Disney coming in and telling them, cease and desist. You cannot use my branded images without my permission, without licensing. It says I don't care about my brand. In 2017, the Cavaliers introduced two new logos. It took 18 months to come up with the two logos, making sure they had the trademarks and color schemes all set and legal, along with it being appealing to the fans. It took 18 months, and then they redid it in 2022 and revealed a new set of logos that worked for them. So these things are big deals. They take a lot of money and a lot of time, and you want to protect them. Here's some leading brands and their various logos, Amazon, Samsung, Walmart, Google, Microsoft, IBM, Coke, and Apple, and Nike. We do have an interesting situation with our brands as the social norms around us change. What was acceptable 100 years ago is not acceptable anymore. Social norms change, sensitivities change, culture changes. We have to be aware of that. And certainly this BLM, Black Lives Matter, and ethnic sensitivity affected brands. So brands create identification, differentiation, and value. But what happens when cultural values, social norms change? Well, most brands need to adjust. So Quaker Oats ended the Aunt Jemima breakfast brand. It's now Pearl Milling Company. Mars changed its Uncle Ben's name to Ben's Original. Conger Brands Mrs. Butterworth underwent a brand review. Dreyer's Ice Cream announced it would change the marketing and the name of its Eskimo Pie brand after nearly 100 years. Since the term Eskimo is now considered derogatory by Native people of the Arctic, it's now Eddie's Pie. When these names first came out, when these brand images first came out, they were fine, given the social milieu, given the norms, given the culture, and then they change. And if you don't make a change, you're going to find a backlash from society towards your brand. Cream of Wheat, owned by B&G Foods, also announced it would conduct a review of its current packaging. It dropped the black chef from the package, who had been there for a good long time. He's now gone. Washington NFL teams, formerly known as the Washington Redskins, called itself the Washington Football Team until it adopted a new name. It's now the Washington Commanders. Cleveland Indians, as you know, consulted with Native American groups, changed its name for the first time since 1915. They're now the Cleveland Guardians. So brands need to adapt their imagery, their name, to changing social norms. Given all this trouble, all this expense, all these problems you run into, why in the world should you brand? Why bother? Well, my wife brought home that product one day. And as you can see, it's clearly new and improved. New and improved what? It's new and improved. What is it? It seems to be some generic brand of, can you tell what it's supposed to be? No? English muffins. New and improved, no-name English muffins. I was not excited about her improved, about her improvement on my breakfast meal. Actually, I think that happened during the pandemic when there wasn't a lot of choice. But that's not a good way to build a loyal group of consumers. Ah, yes. Thompson's English muffins makes sense to me, right? So, for consumers, brands help to identify the product or service. To be silly, imagine wandering down the cereal aisle in your local cereal store looking for your cereal, and there were no brands at all. Maybe it said Corn Flakes, different brand, but you know, Corn Flakes, you'd have to pick it up, read it, see the ingredients. How long would it take you to do shopping? That's nutty. Helps to ensure consistent quality. You know what you're getting when you get the cheap brand versus the expensive brand, or at least you have expectations about that. Makes shopping easier and faster. I just alluded to that. You're able to go right to the store and pick up the one that's yours, your Crest toothpaste, your Thompson muffins. What is that one on the left? It's actually a product, Apple Ricks cereal. I think I'll take the Fruit Licks, thanks. Tomato sauce, it's a real thing. I think I'll take the one that I've heard of. For sellers, brands provide a focus for their promotion. You aren't just selling cereal. You aren't just selling tomato sauce. Brands allow for recognition and differentiation. Ragu is different than Prego. Helps reduce the importance of price comparisons because I want the quality, the taste, the status of the brand that I want. So I'm not so worried about just prices. So these are different reasons on both the consumer side and the seller side. But again, imagine a world in which you didn't know any brand names. I don't know how that would work for you. I don't know how happy you'd be. All right, so are the benefits worth the cost? Well, companies certainly seem to think so. Cody paid $12.5 billion to acquire Wella Hair Care, Clairol Hair Coloring, and CoverGirl makeup brands in an acquisition. For those brand names, they certainly felt it was worth it. So thinking of brands, these guys don't do this update very often. So this is the 2019 Interbrand Best global brands, I'll say announcement or video. We're going to talk about their methodology and what relevant brands do, etc. Let's see if we can get this guy working.
Welcome back to Squawk Box. Big Tech dominating a new report on the most valuable global brands. Joining us right now to talk about all of this is Daniel Binns. He's the CEO of the New York office of Interbrand, which puts this list together every year. So who is at the top this year relative to last year?
Apple again for the seventh year in a row with a valuation of almost $230 billion. So super powerful process for Amazon.
Before we get really deep on this, just the methodology.
It's basically a threefold thing. So we look at the financial performance of the company and its future earnings. We then look at the role of brand, which is basically what we determine to be the amount of the customer decision making, which is built by brand versus functional attributes of the company. And then what we defined as the strength of the brand. So of the tables, $2.1 trillion worth of value in the table overall. $800 billion comes from tech brands. So tech brands do dominate the sector. I mean, they offer incredible service. So as a customer, you're making that value exchange and you're determining that I'm prepared to give you my data in exchange for the amazing products and services that I get.
And then you have more classic companies like McDonald's.
Who would, have done an incredible job of renovating their experience. They're continuing to grow. They're starting to think about the menu in a different way. So we're seeing that brand continue to get relevant. And what we see is that the companies that do well on the list are those that are endlessly responding to customer needs and therefore managing to stay relevant. It's tough because the world is moving very fast. Customer expectation is moving faster than most companies can keep up. So the strongest brands are the ones that are able to transcend, make what we call an iconic move, and sort of shift from the customer expectation.
We were just talking about IBM earnings.
Yeah.
They're number 12 on this list?
They've gone down this year. I mean, it's been obviously a tough year for IBM within that business service.
Is that about today? Is that about the history of it? What is
it? It's about today. I mean, brands built with, over years and years, and the equity that's built into them is something which is invested in and nurtured.
How's IBM?
Finally, Disney's at the end of the list there?
Yeah, number 10. Well, it's into the top 10 for the first time.
Which it was is not really there strong. Before.
It was not there before.
That's so interesting. So because I would have thought that brand actually would have actually been higher on the list on a relative basis.
Yeah, no, it is. It's into the top 10. Obviously, the Disney Plus promise is really powerful. The aggregation, all that content, lots of discussion around Netflix this morning.
Daniel, thank you. Appreciate it.
So you have to be big. You have to be big. You have to be global. And you have to relentlessly respond to those fast-changing consumer demands, needs, wants, and desires in that white water rapids business environment that we've talked about already to stay on the list, to get onto the list. Now, while I said they don't do this all the time in terms of the video, they do update it regularly. So here they are, Interbrand's global rankings in 2021. Apple, still at the top, followed by Amazon, Microsoft, Google, Samsung, Coca-Cola, Toyota, Mercedes-Benz, McDonald's, and Disney, still on that top 10 list, followed by the rest, as you can see. If branding is such a big deal, you might ask a different question. Hey, Larry, how come all products aren't branded? Well, if you're going to brand a product, it brings some responsibilities with it. For example, brands are expensive for you to run and operate. They require expensive promotion for it to make any sense. If you're going to be responsible for your own brand, you better make sure that you have sustained, retained, kept on top of the product's quality. You can't let that slip because it's your name. Branding doesn't make any sense if the product can't be physically differentiated from other brands out there, so you're just wasting money thinking about how you can differentiate this thing in the mind of the consumer because it's a commodity. Everything's the same. What's your favorite brand of oats, wheat, barley, rye? I don't know. It's a commodity. Although somebody one day is going to bring in a clothespin that has a particular brand name on it, I use that as another sort of commodity product. What's your favorite brand of clothespin? I don't know. It's a clothespin. I don't care. So it doesn't make sense to spend a lot of money developing a brand for wheat because you can't physically differentiate it from anything else. If you want to think about developing your own brand, you have to come up with a brand name, a big deal among companies. A good brand name is actually so good that it will contribute to the success of the product. In the customer replacement auto parts area, your battery died. You got to go buy a new battery for your car. How about one called Die Hard? Ooh, sounds like something that would work for me. Since my one just died, I want one that won't die. But the challenge is finding a good brand name. I mean, how many brands come out every year? How many names are there out there? So we're sort of running out of possibilities in some sense, because more than 30,000 products are launched every year. Aren't that many names, you know, many more words in the language. So what are you going to do? How are you going to find a new brand name? So we do funny things. For example, we combine words with numbers to make a brand name. 7-Up, 3M, Chanel No. 5, Phillips 66, 7-Eleven, WD-40, 9 Lives. So combining things to create a new brand name, we can do words with numbers is one way to go. Or we can simply come up with our own word that didn't exist before. We can invent words. Motorola Razr, Lexus, Google, Novartis, Skype, Exxon. Exxon, I think I'd talk about this again later on, maybe, but it's not important. Exxon went through a massive analysis of all languages, likely languages in the world, to find a brand name that didn't already have existing meanings in the mind of the consumers, wasn't close to other words that were out there. And they developed Exxon because it was an entirely blank slate that they could put their brand image on. A good brand name should suggest the benefits, Die Hard, or use of the product. Here's Simmons Mattress Beauty Rest. Ah, seems appropriate name for a mattress, yeah? Is easy to pronounce, spell, and remember. When you think of laundry detergents, what brand comes to your mind right off the top of your head? Tide. Yeah? So pretty easy to remember, pretty easy to spell, pretty easy to pronounce, and also one of the market leaders out there, I'm sure, because it's a good product too and well advertised, but the name is easy to remember, pronounce, and spell. It's good if it's distinctive. It stands out, and that was my example about when Exxon developed their name. There was nothing else out there like it. They did work to make sure it was new, different, stood out. Also really important, it has to be something that can be registered and legally protected. You just sunk a bunch of money in this thing. You don't want somebody to take it. Something, it would be nice to have a brand name that you could adapt to additional product lines. So we saw Starbucks, originally they had teas and coffee on their logo. They took that away because they wanted to expand it just as Starbucks, and then eventually as no name, just the image. Southwest Airlines. Hard to picture if your brand name is Southwest Airlines, what other products you're going to expand into, yeah? It seems like it might be airlines. On the other hand, we know Virgin products, right? Have you heard of Virgin Airlines? Yeah? Yeah, but there's also a few other Virgin product lines out there. So it's pretty adaptable the way they played it out. We have Virgin Records, Virgin Media, Virgin Mobile, Virgin Money, Virgin Games, Virgin Atlantic, Virgin Hotels, Virgin Holidays, Virgin Care. So all of those things work with that brand name, entirely open to extensions.
I'm David Plasek. I'm the founder and president of Lexicon Branding. Our company has come up with some of the world's most well-recognized names. So there's an area of linguistics called sound symbolism, which really says the individual letters of the alphabet, the sound of those letters, evoke certain qualities. So Swiffer is a cleaning product. We said, well, what is the sound of cleaning products? We describe things as sweeping and swiping and mopping. So we started to mimic those sounds, and you go from sweep to swipe, that's not that attractive, so then we put an F on there, and then it becomes Swift. Then we look at legal situations and trademark clutter, and we put an E on it, and then finally we move to an ER.
Stop cleaning. Start Swiffering.
There are five types of names. There's real words. The next block over would be real words that stem from Greek, Latin, and Sanskrit. Then there's compressions, like taking a word and shrinking it down. Then there's constructed words. And then finally, coin solutions. The first thing we do is we try to understand what the story is. We are, as humans, hardwired for story. We don't have to describe it. We don't have to tell people what the product is. But we do have to tell people, hey, listen to us. BlackBerry's an interesting story. They had tried for a number of weeks to develop really what were descriptive names with things like Easy Mail and Pro Mail. They were rejected from a trademark standpoint. We did some research. What we noticed about email and messaging and texting was that people's blood pressure went up. Let's create some names that decrease it. We started pursuing things that relax you. Someone wrote strawberry for summer. Our head linguist, he wrote a little note saying, this is too slow, too long, and underneath it, he wrote blackberry. Coca-Cola's Dasani. Coke came to us under a lot of pressure. They weren't in the bottled water business. So we were able to identify between Mexico and Canada over 900 brands of bottled water. Most of them descriptive. Poland Springs, Aquafina, things like that. And so we had a tremendous trademark barrier to overcome because everyone is trying to be descriptive. Let's create a coin solution. We put S-A-N, the Latin root for health, right in the middle of the word, not in the beginning, because that would lead to sanitary and sanitation and things like that. And then we built letters around that, and now it's Dasani, right? So it's easy to pronounce, has a great pattern, ends with a nice slim I, because people drinking water want to be healthy. We're all about being distinctive, being memorable.
So much, who knew so much had to go into thinking about your brand name, but there's a company that does that for these
companies. I'm David.
Companies. We do have, unfortunately, people who lie, cheat, and steal in the domain of your brand name. This especially falls out in terms of intellectual property theft, costing companies, when I put this together, $600 billion a year, and costs 100,000 jobs in the U.S. I'm curious why I have that. What do I have that hot link to? 2021, U.S.-China Intellectual Property and Regulatory Investigations Playbook, a whole bunch of stuff out there about what's going on in that domain. So, pirates often copy drugs and medicines. Whoa, 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 that drug or medicine I take may not be the one created by the manufacturer. You bet. Substituting other ingredients that are cheaper and untested. In many cases, such ingredients are water or talcum powder. Maybe this isn't harmful if you take it orally, but if it's a product that's supposed to be injected, it can sort of kill you dead. Counterfeit laundry detergent can be harmful to the skin. Counterfeit toys that are made badly with pieces that fall off, made with lead or lead paint, have been known to harm children. Counterfeit automobile parts such as brake pads, tires, shock absorbers, you think you're getting a really good deal on that branded name, failed because it's a cheap imitation, a knockoff, pirated products. Product counterfeiting occurs in a variety of different categories. Here's the dangers of counterfeit pressed Xanax bars. Here's the fake versus real designer purse. Indeed, there's fake versus real soy sauce. Some countries of the world are really serious about cracking down on this stuff. I'd taken a group of young undergrads over to Europe. We were getting off in Geneva, Switzerland. Normally, you go right through, it stunned me. You would just walk right through their customs line. They didn't stop you. You're in Geneva. So we walked through the way we always do, and one lady hasn't come out yet. What's going on? And so I have a group standing here. I go back inside to see what's going on. She had purchased a counterfeit. It doesn't matter which one. I'm trying to think of what her brand now. Some counterfeit branded purse, bag rather, not, you know, big rat bag. The counterfeit ones are made out of plastic. They aren't a heavy-duty product. And already on the trip over, it had begun to tear. The plastic had begun to rip. So even though it had the designer's name on the bag, it was ripping. They said, either you can take this bag in our country and we will fine you 1,000 euros, or you can leave it here, dump all your stuff into this black plastic trash bag and go into the country. She chose the black plastic trash bag route. They were watching for it, eyes on, they caught it, and they were serious about stopping allowing counterfeit goods into their country. So they were quite serious about this issue. Counterfeit toys have been known to harm children. We talked about that. Here's an example of a product that went out. It was counterfeit. Down on the bottom, they're showing you how to recognize it. In the counterfeit, the text alignment on the bottom of the folding carton shifted to the extreme right. Doesn't have a right-hand margin. Doesn't fold properly. What was this drug? This was actually for the treatment of anemia, for HIV, chemotherapy, and cancer, etc. products. This product was not in the right dosage. It wasn't going to do what it was supposed to do. It was going to harm people with cancer. I'm a pirate. I don't care. The World Health Organization estimates that as much as 10% of medicines, not necessarily in the U.S., but worldwide, aren't real. They've been ripped off. Not good. Obviously, we have this in high-tech areas as well, where our products are ripped off. Amazon knows that some of its sites sell counterfeit products. They're trying to solve that problem by letting brands themselves delete the knockoffs from Amazon. So they're taking a new approach to its counterfeit problem by putting brands in control of expunging knockoff products on its site. The company announced a new program called Project Zero that will let brands delete fake listings themselves. So we're trying to protect the brand reputation, image, and revenue. Like other tech platforms, Amazon has long struggled with how to deal with false or misleading information on its site. But when users post fake products on Amazon, they can have lasting impacts on the brands that they're trying to knock off, like pressuring them to lower their prices to compete with the fake versions of themselves. I take your brand, I rip it off, I produce a fake, I put it online, and advertise your brand cheaper than you can sell it for. And people start buying it. What am I going to do? Removing fakes has proved complicated for Amazon, and sometimes the system backfires. One real store on Amazon's marketplace was suspended shortly before Amazon's 217 Prime Day because of fake claim of intellectual property violation by a non-existent law firm. So the issue is complicated. Now Amazon hopes to boost its efforts to eliminate counterfeits by putting power directly in the hands of the brands that it invites into the program. It'll combine self-service counterfeit removal for brands with automated scans of logos and trademarks, unique codes on physical items, help to confirm their authenticity, and brands will be able to delete a listing that they say are fake. Our aim is that customers always receive authentic goods when they shop on Amazon. So it's a big problem, and people have to watch out for it. U.S. Customs seized $1.3 billion in counterfeit goods in 2020. What is most counterfeited in America? It will vary by year. Trademark logos and tags that you see clipped onto the item, onto the clothing, onto the bag. Computers and accessories, fake. Optical media, DVD, games, and CDs. Handbags and wallets valued at more than $200 million. A fake Coach bag, that might have been what the woman had, Coach, is often valued in the hundreds of dollars. The values of some counterfeit Hermes bags is thousands of dollars. Pharmaceuticals we've talked about, personal care items can be counterfeited. Watches and jewelries. Hey, have I shown you my really nice Rolex that I got down the corner? Got a really good deal on it. Estimated the value of $580 million. Like other luxury goods, watches and jewelry are especially vulnerable to trademark infringement. A replica can serve as a status symbol for those who cannot afford the price tag of the original luxury good. If I had a Rolex on, you would know it was fake because I can't afford an original Rolex. Footwear, Nike, for example, is a member of several anti-counterfeiting organizations around the world. They actively support intellectual property legislation, consumer electronics, and clothes and other apparel, the number one ripped-off product line out there. All of these things threaten major brands. There's an area called the gray market or unauthorized sales. It is an altered flow of branded products that have been diverted from authorized sales channels. You know that you can sell your product in Spain, but they aren't going to pay as much for it. So you have a channel distribution that has a lower wholesale price in Spain. Someone then takes those products, your real products targeted for Spain, and reroutes them to New York City and sells them at under your price. They are your brand, but that wasn't what you planned to do with them. That would be an unauthorized sale or a gray market. These unauthorized parties sell those products far below market price, unknown to the customer. They come without support, service, or warranties from the original manufacturer. I got caught up in this accidentally. It wasn't exactly unauthorized sales. I took some students to Europe. The airline broke my camera, back in the days of actual cameras on the way, so I bought a Canon in Geneva, Switzerland. Got it back here. It was a real Canon product, as far as I know. But the display started failing on me. So I took it to a place here and said, hey, can you warranty fix it? They said, nah, this warranty is only good in Europe. It's not good here. Wasn't exactly a gray market, but they also wouldn't cover it. Anyhow, these sorts of things hurt the company's revenue and profit and can threaten the company's reputation when they won't cover the illicit sale of the product. In Geneva, Switzerland, there is an organization called the World Intellectual Property Organization. Again, some of my students in that organization one year. They actually have courses for you. If you find this at all interesting, and most of you won't, but somebody might, you can actually go to WIPO and find courses about how to protect intellectual property globally. So how do we protect our brand name? Well, we need to protect it not just from being counterfeited, but from generic usage. Becoming generic happens to brands when they don't properly protect their name and their name becomes common usage for the product. All these things were once brands. Trampoline, yo-yo, aspirin, linoleum, escalator, shredded wheat, thermos were at one time branded names. By the way, what would you call a trampoline if you didn't call it a trampoline? A springy rubber jump-on thing? I don't know what you would call it. And that becomes one of the issues for becoming generic. If there's no simple generic word for the available for the product, and so people start using that word every time they talk about it, like trampoline, and you don't protect it, you don't stop it, it can go generic. You promote it too well, so whenever anybody thinks about the product category, all they think of is your name, and they start using it, and you don't protect it. It's too well. When we think of a tissue, how many of us just automatically think of Kleenex? Okay? They have to make sure that they're registered, that they're making the point it's trademark protected. You ever go into a restaurant, drugstore, and you're ordering a drink, and you say, I'd like a Coke, and they say, we only serve Pepsi here, or the other way around. They make a point of that. That's because those brands are telling them, you need to represent our brand as us. Don't be going generic with the brand name. So we protect it by indicating that it is trademarked. How do we do that? We do that with the little circle on all of our advertisement, registered trademark. When we came out with this special trademark with Kent State University for its centennial, the original one didn't have the little R, which you can barely see here. So technically, it did not indicate it was a registered trademark. You'd say, who cares? We found, indeed, there was an entity in China selling Kent State University degrees. Not only because of that, but we were being ripped off. So indicate it with a trademark. If you're going to have a generic name with a brand name, add them, use them together all the time. So we're Dacron polyester. Use them together. And always popular. Sue. All right, so it's just about magic hour. Have a pleasant Halloween. This is the end of material for mini test, whatever we're on. 9-ish, I think. All right, see you next time.